by unblinking realism. Having no protectors or enemies, in Carnap's expression, humanity must find its way to transcendent existence solely by its own intelligence and will. Science is simply the best instrument at our disposal. As the Vienna Circle had declared a decade earlier, the scientific world conception serves life and in turn is taken up by life. The second level, requisite to the first, was the search for pure standards against which scientific knowledge can be judged. Every symbol, the logical positivists concluded, should denote something real. It should be consistent with the total structure of established facts and theories, with no revelations or free-flight generalizing allowed. Theory must follow in lockstep with facts. Finally, the informational content of language is to be carefully distinguished from its emotional content. To these various ends, verification is all important. Indeed, the very meaning of a statement is its method of verification. If the guidelines are progressively refined and followed, we will in time close in on objective truth. While this happens, ignorance-based metaphysics will back away step by step like a vampire before the lifted cross. The logical positivists who met in Cambridge knew that pure mathematics was on the road to the Grail, but not the prize itself. Mathematics, for all its unchallengeable power in framing theory, is tautological. That is, every conclusion follows completely from its own premises, which may or may not have anything to do with the real world. Mathematicians invent and prove lemmas and theorems that lead to other lemmas and theorems, and onward, with no end in sight. Some fit data from the material world, some do not. The greatest mathematicians are intellectual athletes of dazzling skill. Sometimes they hit upon concepts that open new domains of abstract thought. Complex numbers, linear transformations, and harmonic functions are among those that have proved most interesting mathematically, as well as useful to science. Pure mathematics is the science of all conceivable worlds, a logically closed system, yet infinite in all directions allowed by starting premises. With it, we might, if given unlimited time and computational capacity, describe every imaginable universe. But mathematics alone cannot inform us of the very special world in which we live. Only observation can disclose the periodic table, the Hubble constant, and all the other certainties of our existence, which may be different or non-existent in other universes. Because physics, chemistry, and biology are constrained by the parameters of this universe, the one we see from inside the Milky Way, they compose the science of all possible phenomena tangible to us. Still, because of its effectiveness in the natural sciences, mathematics seems to point arrow-like toward the ultimate goal of objective truth. The logical positivists were especially impressed by the tight meshing of observation with abstract mathematical theory in quantum and relativistic physics. The greatest of 20th century triumphs inspired new confidence in the inborn power of the human brain. Think of it. Here is Homo sapiens, a primate species barely out of its Stone Age villages, correctly divining phenomena almost unimaginably beyond ordinary experience. Surely, the theorists reasoned, we are close to a general formula for objective truth. Yet the Grail eluded them. Logical positivism stumbled and halted. Today, its analyses, while favored by a few, are more commonly studied in philosophy, as dinosaur fossils are studied in paleontology laboratories to understand the causes of extinction. Its last stand may have been a seldom-read 1956 monograph by Carnap in Minnesota Studies in the Philosophy of Science. The fatal flaw was in the semantic linchpin of the whole system. The founders and their followers could not agree on the basic distinctions between fact and concept, between empirical generalization and mathematical truth, between theory and speculation, and from a collation of all these fog-shrouded dichotomies, the differences between scientific and non-scientific statements. Logical positivism was the most valiant, concerted effort ever mounted by modern philosophers. Its failure, or put more generously, its shortcoming, was caused by ignorance of how the brain works. That, in my opinion, is the whole story. No one, philosopher or scientist, could explain the physical acts of observation and reasoning in other than highly subjective terms. Not much has improved in the past 50 years. The mindscape is now under active exploration, but still largely unmapped. Scientific discourse, the focus of logical positivism, comprises the most complex of mental operations, and the brain is a messy place at best, even when handling the most elementary of ideas. Scientists themselves do not think in straight lines. They contrive concepts, evidence, relevance, connections, and analysis as they go along, parsing it all into fragments and in no particular order. Herbert Simon, a Nobelist who has devoted part of his career to the subject, says of the complexity of concept formation, "What chiefly characterizes creative thinking from more mundane forms are, 1. Willingness to accept vaguely defined problem statements and gradually structure them. 2. Continuing preoccupation with problems over a considerable period of time. And 3. Extensive background knowledge in relevant and potentially relevant areas." To put that in a nutshell, knowledge, obsession, daring. The creative process is an opaque mix. Perhaps only openly confessional memoirs, still rare to non-existent, might disclose how scientists actually find their way to a publishable conclusion. In one sense, scientific articles are deliberately misleading. Just as a novel is better than the novelist, a scientific report is better than the scientist, having been stripped of all the confusions and ignoble thought that led to its composition. Yet such voluminous and incomprehensible chaff, soon to be forgotten, contains most of the secrets of scientific success. The canonical definition of objective scientific knowledge, avidly sought by the logical positivists, is not a philosophical problem, nor can it be attained, as they hoped, by logical and semantic analysis. It is an empirical question that can be answered only by a continuing probe of the physical basis of the thought process itself. The most fruitful procedures will almost certainly include the use of artificial intelligence, aided in time by the still embryonic field of artificial emotion, to simulate complex mental operations. This modeling system will be joined to an already swiftly maturing neurobiology of the brain, including the high-resolution scanning of computational networks active in various forms of thought. Important advances will also come from the molecular biology of the learning process. If the exact biological processes of concept formation can be defined, we might devise superior methods of inquiry into both the brain and the world outside it. As a consequence, we could expect to tighten the connectedness between the events and laws of nature and the physical basis of human thought processes. Might it be possible, then, to take the final step and devise an unassailable definition of objective truth? Perhaps not. The very idea is risky. It smells of absolutism, the dangerous Medusa of science and the humanities alike. Its premature acceptance is likely to be more paralyzing than its denial. But should we then be prepared to give up? Never. Better to steer by a lodestar than to drift across a meaningless sea. I think we will know if we come close to the goal of our predecessors, even if unattainable. Its glow will be caught in the elegance and beauty and power of our shared ideas, and in the best spirit of philosophical pragmatism, the wisdom of our conduct. Chapter 5. Ariadne's Thread. With the aid of the scientific method, we have gained an encompassing view of the physical world far beyond the dreams of earlier generations. The great adventure is now beginning to turn inward toward ourselves. In the last several decades, the natural sciences have expanded to reach the borders of the social sciences and humanities. There, the principle of consilient explanation guiding the advance must undergo its severest test. The physical sciences have been relatively easy. The social sciences and humanities will be the ultimate challenge. This uncertain conjunction of the disciplines has mythic elements that would have pleased the ancient Greeks. Treacherous road, heroic journey, secret instructions that lead us home. The elements have been assembled into many narratives over the centuries. Among them is the story of the Cretan labyrinth, which can also serve as a metaphor of consilience. Into the heart of the Cretan labyrinth walks Theseus, Heracles-like champion of Athens. Through each corridor, past uncounted twists and turns, he unravels a ball of thread given him by Ariadne, love-struck daughter of Crete's King Minos. Somewhere in the hidden passages, he meets the Minotaur, the cannibal half-man, half-bull, to whom 7 youths and maidens are sacrificed each year as Athens' tribute to Crete. Theseus kills the Minotaur with his bare hands. Then, following Ariadne's thread, he retraces his steps through and out of the labyrinth. The labyrinth, its likely origin, a prehistoric conflict between Crete and Attica, is a fitting mythic image of the uncharted material world in which humanity was born and which it forever struggles to understand. Consilience among the branches of learning is the Ariadne's thread needed to traverse it. Theseus is humanity, the Minotaur our own dangerous irrationality. Near the entrance of the labyrinth of empirical knowledge is physics, comprising one gallery, then a few branching galleries that all searchers undertaking the journey must follow. In the deep interior is a nebula of pathways through the social sciences, humanities, art, and religion. If the thread of connecting causal explanations has been well laid, it is nonetheless possible to follow any pathway quickly in reverse back through the behavioral sciences to biology, chemistry, and finally physics. With time, we discover that the labyrinth has a troubling peculiarity that makes its complete mastery impossible. While there is an entrance, more or less, there is no center, only an immense number of endpoints deep within the maze. In tracking the thread backward, from effect to cause, assuming we have enough knowledge to do so, we can begin with only one endpoint. The labyrinth of the real world is thus a Borgesian maze of almost infinite possibility. We can never map it all, never discover and explain everything, but we can hope to travel through the known parts swiftly, from the specific back to the general, and in resonance with the human spirit, We can go on tracing pathways forever. We can connect threads into broadening webs of explanation because we have been given the torch and the ball of thread. There is another defining character of consilience. It is far easier to go backward through the branching corridors than to go forward. After segments of explanation have been laid, one at a time, one level of organization to the next, to many endpoints, say geological formations or species of butterflies, we can choose any thread and reasonably expect to follow it through the branching points of causation all the way back to the laws of physics. But the opposite journey, from physics to endpoints, is extremely problematic. As the distance away from physics increases, the options allowed by the antecedent disciplines increase exponentially. Each branching point of causal explanation multiplies the forward-bound threads. Biology is almost unimaginably more complex than physics, and the arts equivalently more complex than biology. To stay on course all the way seems impossible. And worse, we cannot know before departure whether the complete journey we have imagined even exists. The accelerating growth of forward-bound complexity from entrance to endpoints is illustrated with textbook clarity by cell biology. Researchers have used the reductionist principles of physics and chemistry to explain cellular structure and activity in admirably brilliant detail, with no discernible room left for rival approaches. They expect in time to explain everything about any particular kind of cell chosen for study, reducing it organelle by organelle, and finally reassembling it holistically, thus traveling toward the labyrinth entrance and simplicity. But they nourish faint hope of predicting, as opposed to explaining and reconstructing retrodictively, the character of any complete cell from physics and chemistry, hence traveling away from the labyrinth entrance toward rising complexity. To recite one of the mantras of science, the explanations of the physical sciences are necessary but not sufficient. There is too much idiosyncrasy in the arrangement of a particular cell's nucleus and other organelles, as well as the molecules composing them, and too much complexity in the cell's constantly shifting chemical exchanges with the environment to accomplish such a conceptual traverse. And beyond these particularities awaits the still hidden history of the prescriptive DNA stretched across countless generations. Put briefly, the questions of interest are how the cell is put together and what was the evolutionary history that led to its prescription. In order to proceed, biologists are compelled first to describe complexity in the cell, then break it down. To go the other way is conceivable, but the biologists all agree it will be forbiddingly difficult. To dissect a phenomenon into its elements, in this case, cell into organelles and molecules, is consilience by reduction. To reconstitute it, and especially to predict with knowledge gained by reduction how nature assembled it in the first place, is consilience by synthesis. That is the two-step procedure by which natural scientists generally work, top-down across two or three levels of organization at a time, by analysis, then bottom-up across the same levels, by synthesis. The procedure can be simply illustrated with a modest example from my own research. Ants alert one another to danger at a distance. When a worker ant is jostled, pinned to the ground, or otherwise threatened, nest mates, up to several inches away, somehow sense her distress and rush to her aid. Her, I say, because all workers are female. Alarm can be communicated by sight, but only rarely, since confrontations usually occur in the dark, and in any case, many kinds of ants are blind. The signal can also be transmitted by sound. Agitated workers make squeaking noises by rubbing their waists against a rear segment of their bodies, or else repeatedly pump their bodies up and down to strike the ground. But again, sound is used only by some species, and then only on special occasions. Knowing these facts in the 1950s as a beginning entomologist, I speculated that the key alarm signals are chemical. The substances are what researchers in those days called chemical releasers, and today are known as pheromones. To test my idea, I collected colonies of red harvester ants and a few other species whose natural history I knew well. Then I installed them in artificial nests not much different from a child's ant farm. With the aid of a dissecting microscope and watchmaker's forceps, I dissected freshly killed workers to obtain organs that might contain alarm pheromones. I crushed each one of these barely visible white gobbets of tissue onto the sharpened tips of applicator sticks and presented them, in turn, to resting groups of workers. In that way, I learned that at least two of the glands are active. One opens at the base of the mandibles, and the other next to the anus. The ants were galvanized by the substances released from the glands. They raced back and forth in whirligig loops around the applicator sticks, pausing only occasionally to examine and snap at the crushed tissue. I had pinpointed the origin of the pheromones, but what were they? I enlisted the help of Fred Rainier, a chemist of like age, just starting his own career. He was expert in the skills most needed at that time to advance the study of ant communication, the analysis of extremely small organic samples. Using the latest techniques of the day, gas chromatography and mass spectrometry, Rainier identified the active substances as a medley of simple compounds called alkanes and terpenoids. He then obtained samples of identical compounds that had been synthesized in the laboratory, guaranteeing their purity. Presenting minute quantities to the ant colonies, we obtained the same responses I had observed in my first experiments and confirmed that the glandular components Rainier had identified were the alarm pheromones. This information was the first step to the understanding of broader and more basic phenomena. I next enlisted the help of William Bossert, a young mathematician. We were all young in those days. Young scientists have the best ideas, and more important, the most time. Intrigued by the novelty of the problem, as well as by the small stipend I offered him, he agreed to construct physical models of the diffusion of the pheromones. We knew that chemicals evaporate from the gland openings. The molecules closest to the openings are dense enough to be smelled by the ants. The three-dimensional domain within which this occurs, we called the active space. The geometrical form of the active space can be predicted from knowledge of the physical properties of the molecules and confirmed by the time required for the expanding cloud of molecules to alert the ants. We used both the models and experiments to measure the rate of spread of the molecules and the sensitivity of the ants to them, and established, with reasonable certainty, that workers release evaporated pheromones in order to communicate. The steps in reasoning we followed are universal in scientific research. They follow from the consilience of the disciplines established by generations of earlier scientists. To solve the problem of alarm communication in ants, we employed reduction, working our way down from one level of specific organization, namely the organism, to a more general level, the molecule. We tried to explain a phenomenon in biology with physics and chemistry. Luckily, our ideas succeeded this time. The same approach to pheromone research continued to be rewarded in the decades to follow. Scores of biologists working independently established that ants organize their colonies with many chemical systems like those used to transmit alarm. Their bodies, we discovered, are walking batteries of glands filled with semiotic compounds. When ants dispense their pheromones, singly or in combination, and in varying amounts, they say to other ants, in effect, "Danger, come quickly," or "Danger, disperse," or "Food, follow me," or "There is a better nest site, follow me," or "I am a nestmate, not an alien," or "I am a larva," and on through a repertoire of 10 to 20 messages, with the number differing according to caste, such as soldier or minor worker, and species. So pervasive and powerful are these codes of taste and smell that altogether they bind ant colonies into a single operational unit. As a result, each colony can be viewed as a superorganism, a congeries of conventional organisms acting like a single and much larger organism. The colony is a primitive semiotic web that crudely resembles a nerve net, a hundred-mouthed hydra writ large. Touch one ant, one strand of the net, and the displacement spreads out to engage the communal intelligence. We had crossed four levels, superorganism to organism to glands and sense organs to molecules. Was it possible then to turn around and travel in the opposite direction, predicting the outcome without advanced knowledge of the biology of the ants? Yes, at least in the form of a few broad principles. From the theory of natural selection, molecules serving as pheromones can be expected to possess certain properties that allow efficient manufacture and transmission. Adding in principles of organic chemistry, we concluded that the molecules will likely contain 5 to 20 carbon atoms and have molecular weights between 80 and 300. Molecules acting as alarm pheromones in particular will usually be on the light side. They will be produced in comparatively large quantities, for example, millionths rather than billionths of a gram in each ant, and the responding workers will be less sensitive to them than to most other kinds of pheromones. This combination of traits allows quick transmission followed by a rapid fade-out of the signal after the danger passes. In contrast, trail substances, which are followed by the ants from nest to food and back, can be predicted to consist of molecules with the opposite qualities. Their traits allow long duration of the signal, as well as ensuring privacy of transmission. This privacy prevents predators from locking onto the signals and hunting down the senders. In war, and nature is a battlefield, make no mistake, one needs secret codes. These predictions, or educated guesses, if you prefer, qualify as consilience by synthesis. With some puzzling exceptions, they have been confirmed. But biologists cannot predict from physics and chemistry alone the exact structure of the pheromone molecules or the identity of the glands that manufacture them. For that matter, in advance of experiments, they cannot stipulate whether a given signal is used or not used by a particular species of ant. To attain that level of accuracy, to travel all the way from physics and chemistry near the entrance of the labyrinth to an end point in the social life of ants, we need detailed collateral knowledge of the evolutionary history of the species and of the environment in which it lives. Predictive synthesis, in short, is formidably difficult. On the other hand, I believe that explanation in the opposite direction, by reduction, can, in some instances, be achieved across all levels of organization and hence all branches of learning. As a demonstration, I will now attempt to trace a magician's dream all the way down to an atom. Serpents are in the magician's dream, transfigured from real-life snakes. I have not placed them there capriciously. They belong, as the wild creatures most frequently conjured around the world in dreams and drug-induced hallucinations. Coming with ease to Zulu and Manhattanite alike, serpents are powerful images of human fantasy, flesh and blood snakes transformed into flickering images of the subconscious mind. There, depending on the culture and experience of the individual dreamer, they are conjured variously as predators, menacing demons, guardians of a hidden world, oracles, spirits of the dead, and gods. The slithering bodies and lethal strikes of real snakes make them ideal for magic. Their images evoke blends of emotion that fall on a triangular gradient defined by the three points of fear, revulsion, and reverential awe. Where the real snake frightens, the dream serpent transfixes. In the dreamer's paralytic state of sleep, the serpent cannot be escaped. Snakes are abundant and diverse in the rainforests of western Amazonia. Serpents, their dream equivalents, figure prominently in the cultures of the Amerindian and Mestizo inhabitants. Shamans preside over the taking of hallucinogenic drugs and interpret the meaning of the serpents and other apparitions that subsequently emerge. The Jivaro of Ecuador use maicua, the juice from the green bark of a member of the nightshade family, Datura arborea. Warriors drink it to summon arutums, ancestors living in the spirit world. If the seeker is fortunate, a spirit emerges from the depths of the forest, often in the form of two giant anacondas, which in real life is the species Eunectus morinus, heaviest of the world's snakes, big enough to kill a human being. The dream serpents roll toward him, entwined in combat. When they come within 20 or 30 feet, the Jivaro must run forward and touch them. Otherwise, they will explode like dynamite and disappear. After receiving his vision, the Jivaro must tell no one, or else the spell will end. That night, he sleeps on the bank of the nearest river, and as he dreams, the arutum returns to him as an old man. It says, "I am your ancestor. Just as I have lived a long time, so will you. Just as I have killed many times, so will you." The apparition then disappears, and as it does, its soul enters the body of the dreamer. The Jivaro rises at dawn with an enhanced feeling of bravery and grace in bearing. His new demeanor is noted by others in the scattered households of the local Jivaro community. If he wishes, he can don the bird-bone shoulder ornament that symbolizes arutum soul power. In the old days, he would have been considered fit to serve as a warrior on headhunting expeditions. 500 miles southeast in Amazonian Peru lives Pablo Amaringo, mestizo shaman and artist. Drawing on the traditions of his Amerindian forebears, the Cocama and Quechua speakers of Amazonas and Cajamarca, Amaringo conjures visions and depicts them in paintings. His drug of choice, widely used in communities of the Rio Ucayali region, is ayahuasca, extracted from the jungle vine Bani Stereopsis. His dreams are populated with serpents in most of their Amazonian cultural roles, mounts of gods, forest spirits, ambush predators of animals and people, impregnators of women, landlords of lakes and forests, and sometimes the sinuous ayahuasca vine itself, transmuted into animal form. In the rich local Shipibo tradition, followed by Amaringo in his paintings, the serpents, as well as other real and supernatural beings, are decorated with intricate geometric designs in primary colors. The paintings also share the Shipibo horror wakui. Every available space is crowded with detail. The style fits the Amazon region, which teems with life of stupendous variety. Amaringo's subjects are loosely eclectic. Spirits and conjurers and fantastical animals from ancient Amerindian myths are thrown together with contemporary Peruvians and industrial artifacts. Ships and airplanes pass by. Even flying saucers hover above the rainforest canopy. The images, surreal and disturbing, freed from normal sensory input, are incarnate emotions in search of theater and narrative. Their craziness illustrates the principle that during trances and dreaming, any metaphor serves, and any fragment of memory able to slip into the unguarded mind becomes part of the story. The sacred plants, which have been analyzed by chemists, are no longer mysterious. Their juices are laced with neuromodulators that, in large oral doses, produce a state of excitation, delirium, and vision. The primary effects are often followed by narcosis and dreaming of similar kind. In the Jivaros Datura, they are the structurally similar alkaloids atropine and scopolamine. In Bani Stereopsis of the Mestizos, they include beta-carbolines, to which the shamans usually add dimethyltryptamine from another plant species. The substances are psychotropic, stimulating a flurry of images intense enough to break through the controlled processes of ordinary conscious thought. They alter the brain in the same manner as the natural neuromodulator molecules that regulate normal dreaming. The difference is that under their influence, people enter a semi-comatose trance in which dreaming, uncontrolled and often vivid and urgent, is no longer confined to sleep. It is tempting to patronize these spiritual searches of the Amazonian vegetalistas, just as it is easy to dismiss the counterculture's innocent faith in drug-soaked gurus and sorcerers during the 1960s and 1970s. Outside of a few cults, few people today believe in the late drug guru Timothy Leary, or even remember Carlos Castaneda and his once famous The Teachings of Don Juan. Yet it would be a mistake to underestimate the importance of such visions. They tell us something important about biology and human nature. For millennia, the use of hallucinogens to enhance inner awareness has been widespread through the cultures of the world. Natural sleep and drug-induced dreams have long been viewed in Western civilization as a portal to the divine. They appear at pivotal moments in both the Old and New Testaments. We learn from Matthew chapter 1, verse 20, for example, that as Joseph pondered Mary's pregnancy, the conception of Jesus, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream to reveal the Holy Spirit as progenitor. Joseph's witness established one of the two essential pillars of Christian belief, the other being the disciples' account of the resurrection, also dreamlike. Emanuel Swedenborg, the 18th century scientist and theologian whose followers founded the Church of the New Jerusalem, believed that dreams contain secrets of the divine. God does not restrict his word to Holy Scripture. If the sacred code cannot be found under the microscope, as the Swedish savant discovered to his disappointment, It might yet be forthcoming in the scenarios of the dream world. Swedenborg recommended irregular hours and sleep deprivation as a means of inducing sharper and more frequent images. At least he had his physiology right. I suspect that he would have enjoyed a stiff dose of ayahuasca. Consider, then, the dreams of a magician, a sorcerer, a shaman. They are more than just unique productions of a single mind. They exhibit qualities general to the human species. The art of Pablo Amaringo is worthy of analysis in the manner of the natural sciences. His paintings are a test case of consilience, an arresting fragment of culture that might be explained and thereby given added meaning at the next biological level down in complexity from artistic inspiration. It is the habit of scientists to look for elements available as entry points for such analysis. To this end, I have chosen two elements from Amaringo's paintings that present themselves for convenient explanation: the dreamscape as a whole, and the serpents that conspicuously populate it. Mysticism and science meet in dreams. Freud, aware of the conjunction, composed a hypothesis to explain their meaning. He said that our dreams are disguises for unconscious wishes. When we sleep, the ego releases its grip on the id, which is the embodiment of instinct, and our most primitive fears and desires then escape into the conscious mind. They are not, however, experienced in raw form. Like characters in a bad Victorian novel, they are altered by the mind's censor into symbols, so as not to disrupt sleep. The average person cannot expect to read their meaning accurately upon awakening. He must turn, Freud argued, to a psychoanalyst who will guide him through free association in order to decipher the codes. As the translations are made, the connections of the symbols to childhood experience become clear. If the revelation unfolds correctly, the patient enjoys an easing of neuroses and other psychological disturbances that stem from his repressed memories. Freud's conception of the unconscious, by focusing attention on hidden, irrational processes of the brain, was a fundamental contribution to culture. It became a wellspring of ideas flowing from psychology into the humanities. But it is mostly wrong. Freud's fatal error was his abiding reluctance to test his own theories, to stand them up against competing explanations, then revise them to accommodate controverting facts. He also suffered from the luck of the draw. The actors of his drama, id, ego, and superego, and the roles they played in suppression and transference, might have evolved smoothly into the elements of a modern scientific theory had he guessed their basic nature correctly. Darwin's theory of natural selection prospered that way, even though the great naturalist had no idea of particulate heredity carried by genes. Only later did modern genetics verify his insight concerning the evolutionary process. In dreams, Freud was faced with a far more complex and intractable set of elements than genes, and, to put it as kindly as possible, he guessed wrong. The competing and more modern hypothesis of the basic nature of dreaming is the activation synthesis model of biology. As created during the past two decades by J. Allen Hobson of Harvard Medical School and other researchers, it pieces together our deepening knowledge of the actual cellular and molecular events that occur in the brain during dreaming. In brief, dreaming is a kind of insanity, a rush of visions, largely unconnected to reality, emotion-charged and symbol-drenched, arbitrary in content, and potentially infinite in variety. Dreaming is very likely a side effect of the reorganization and editing of information in the memory banks of the brain. It is not, as Freud envisioned, the result of savage emotions and hidden memories that slip past the brain's sensor. The facts behind the activation synthesis hypothesis can be interpreted as follows. During sleep, when almost all sensory input ceases, the conscious brain is activated internally by impulses originating in the brain stem. It scrambles to perform its usual function, which is to create images that move through coherent narratives. But lacking moment-by-moment input of sensory information, including stimuli generated by body motion, it remains unconnected to external reality. Therefore, it does the best it can. It creates fantasy. The conscious brain, regaining control upon awakening, and with all its sensory and motor inputs restored, reviews the fantasy and tries to give it a rational explanation. The explanation fails, and as a result, dream interpretation itself becomes a kind of fantasy. That is the reason psychoanalytic theories relating to dreaming, as well as parallel supernatural interpretations arising in myth and religion, are at one and the same time emotionally convincing and factually incorrect. The molecular basis of dreaming is understood in part. Sleep descends upon the brain when chemical nerve cell transmitters of a certain kind, amines such as norepinephrine and serotonin, decline in amount. Simultaneously, a transmitter of a second kind, acetylcholine, rises in amount. Both wash the junctions of nerve cells specialized to be sensitive to them. The two kinds of neurotransmitters exist in a dynamic balance. The amines waken the brain and mediate its control of the sensory systems and voluntary muscles. Acetylcholine shuts these organs down. As acetylcholine gains ascendancy, the activities of the conscious brain are reduced. So are other functions of the body, except for circulation, respiration, digestion, and, remarkably, movement of the eyeballs. The voluntary muscles of the body are paralyzed during sleep. Temperature regulation is also diminished. That is why it can be dangerous to fall asleep while the body is cold. In a normal nocturnal cycle, sleep is at first deep and dreamless, then at intervals, consuming overall about 25% of the total sleep period, it turns shallow. During the shallow periods, the sleeper is more easily awakened. His eyes move erratically in their sockets, the condition called rapid eye movement, or REM. The conscious brain stirs and dreams, but remains sealed off from external stimuli. Dreaming is triggered when acetylcholine nerve cells in the brainstem begin to fire wildly, initiating what are called PGO waves. The electrical membrane activity, still mediated by acetylcholine at the nerve junctions, moves from the pons, the P of PGO, a bulbous mass of nerve centers located at the top of the brainstem, upward to the lower center of the brain mass, where it enters the geniculate nuclei, G, of the thalamus, which are major switching centers in the visual neuronal pathways. The PGO waves then pass on to the occipital cortex, O, at the rear of the brain, where integration of visual information takes place. Because the pons is also a principal control station for motor activity when the brain is awake, the signals it passes through the PGO system falsely report to the cortex that the body is in motion. But of course, the body is immobile. In fact, it is paralyzed. What the visual brain does then is to hallucinate. It pulls images and stories out of the memory banks and integrates them in response to the waves arriving from the pons. unconstrained by information from the outside world, deprived of context and continuity in real space and time, the brain hastily constructs images that are often phantasmagoric and engaged in events that are impossible. We fly through the air, swim in the deep sea, walk on a distant planet, converse with a long-dead parent. People, wild animals, and nameless apparitions come and go. Some constitute the materialization of our emotions triggered by the PGO surges, so that from dream to dream, our mood is variously calm, fear-struck, angry, erotic, maudlin, humorous, lyrical, but most of the time, just anxious. There seems to be no limit to the combinatorial power of the dreaming brain, and whatever we see, we believe, at least while sleeping. It rarely occurs to us to doubt even the most bizarre events into which we have been involuntarily thrust. Someone has defined insanity as an inability to choose among false alternatives. In dreams, we are insane. We wander across our limitless dreamscapes as madmen. Strong stimuli can break through the sensory barrier. If they do not wake us, they are fitted into the dream story. Let real thunder roll into our bedroom from lightning a mile away. To take one of endless possible responses, our dream switches to a bank robbery. A gun is fired. We are shot. No, another person is shot, has fallen. But no again. We realize it is us, displaced to someone else's body. Oddly, we feel no pain. Then the scene changes. We are walking down a long corridor, lost, anxious to get home. Another shot is fired. This time, we come awake, tense, to lie still in the real world and listen to real thunder roll in from the approaching storm outside. In dreams, we seldom experience the physical discomforts of pain, nausea, thirst, or hunger. A few people suffer apnea, a temporary halt in breathing, which may be turned into visions of suffocation or drowning. There is no smell or taste in dreams. The channels of these sensory circuits are shut down by the acetylcholine wash of the sleeping brain. Unless we wake soon afterward, we remember no details of any kind. 95% to 99% of dreams are forgotten completely. A small minority of persons believe, erroneously, that they do not dream at all. This amazing amnesia is apparently due to the low concentration of amine transmitters, which are needed to convert short-term memories into longer ones. What is the function of dreaming? Biologists have tentatively concluded from detailed studies of animals and humans that the information learned while the brain is awake is sorted and consolidated while it is asleep. There is further evidence that at least some of this processing, particularly the sharpening of cognitive skills by repetition, is limited to periods of REM sleeping and therefore to dream time. The flow of acetylcholine itself may be a crucial part of the process. The fact that dreaming activates such intense inward motor and emotional activity has led some researchers to suggest that REM sleep has an even more profound Darwinian function. When we dream, we deepen moods and improve responses basic to survival and sexual activity. The findings from neurobiology and experimental psychology, nevertheless, say nothing about the content of the dreams. Are the fantasies all temporary insanity? The sum of quickly forgotten epiphenomena during the consolidation of learning? Or can we search in some neo-Freudian manner for deep meaning in the symbols from which dreams are composed? Because dreams are not entirely random, the truth must lie somewhere in between. The composition may be irrational, but the details comprise fragments of information appropriate to the emotions activated by the PGO waves. It is quite possible that the brain is genetically predisposed to fabricate certain images and episodes more than others. These fragments may correspond in a loose way to Freud's instinctual drives and to the archetypes of Jungian psychoanalysis. Both theories can perhaps be made more concrete and verifiable by neurobiology. Genetic predisposition and evolution lead to the second element I have chosen from the Amerigo paintings, serpents. The form of our understanding of these creatures of the night is the exact opposite of that concerning the nature of dreams in general. As I have just explained, biologists now understand in very general terms how dreams happen. They have puzzled through many of the key cellular and molecular events of dreaming. They are much less sure of the good the dreams do, mind and body. In the case of the prevalence of serpents, the situation is reversed. Biologists have a sound working hypothesis on the function of the images, but as yet, no idea of their molecular and cellular basis beyond the general control of dreaming. The mystery as to the exact mechanism is due to our ignorance of the cellular processes by which specific memories, such as those of serpents, are assembled and colored by emotion. What we know about serpents as dream images can be expressed by the two key modes of analysis used in biology. The first mode exposes proximate causes, the entities and physiological processes that create the phenomenon. Proximate explanations answer the question of how biological phenomena work, usually at the cellular and molecular levels. The second mode of explanation addresses why they work, their ultimate causes, which are the advantages the organism enjoys as a result of evolution that created the mechanisms in the first place. Biologists aim for both proximate and ultimate explanations. To put the study of dreaming in a nutshell, we understand a good deal about the proximate causes of dreaming in general, but very little about its ultimate causes, while the reverse is true for the presence of serpents in dreams. The account I will now give of the ultimate cause of the bond between snake and man has been pieced together from accounts of animal and human behavior by many researchers, and most fully by the American anthropologist and art historian Balaji Mondkur. Fear of snakes is deep and primordial among the old world primates, the phylogenetic group to which Homo sapiens belongs. When vervets and other gnomes, common long-tailed arboreal monkeys of Africa, encounter certain kinds of snakes, they emit a unique chuttering call. They are, evidently, good instinctive herpetologists, because the response, which appears to be inborn, is limited to the poisonous cobras, mambas, and puff adders. The response is not made to harmless snakes. Others of the monkey group come to the side of the caller, and together they watch the intruder until it leaves the neighborhood. They are also ready with an inborn eagle call, causing all the troop members to scramble down from the trees and out of danger, and an inborn leopard call, triggering a rush in the opposite direction to parts of the canopy that big cats cannot reach. Common chimpanzees, a species believed to share a common ancestor with prehumans as recently as 5 million years ago, are unusually apprehensive in the presence of snakes. Even if they have had no previous experience, they back off to a safe distance and follow the intruder with a fixed stare while alerting companions with a wah warning call. The response gradually intensifies during adolescence. Human beings also possess an innate aversion to snakes, and as in the chimpanzee, it grows stronger during adolescence. The reaction is not a hardwired instinct. It is a bias in development of the kind psychologists call prepared learning. Children simply learn fear of snakes more easily than they remain indifferent or learn affection for snakes. Before the age of 5, they feel no special anxiety. Later, they grow increasingly wary. Then, just one or two bad experiences, a snake writhing nearby through the grass, or a frightening story, can make them deeply and permanently afraid. The propensity is deep set. Other common fears of the dark, strangers, loud noises, start to wane after 7 years of age. In contrast, the tendency to avoid snakes grows stronger with time. It is possible to turn in the opposite direction, learning to handle snakes without fear, or even to like them in some special way. I did as a boy, and once thought seriously of becoming a professional herpetologist. But the adaptation was for me forced and self-conscious. People's special sensitivity can just as easily turn into full-blown ophidiophobia, the pathological extreme in which the close proximity of a snake brings on panic, cold sweat, and waves of nausea. The neural pathways of snake aversion have not been explored. We do not know the proximate cause of the phenomenon, except to classify it as prepared learning. In contrast, the probable ultimate cause, the survival value of the aversion, is well understood. Throughout human history, a few kinds of snakes have been a major cause of sickness and death. Every continent except Antarctica has poisonous snakes. Over most of Africa and Asia, the known death rate from snake bite is 5 persons per 100,000 each year. The local record is held by a province in Burma, lately called Myanmar. 36.8 deaths per 100,000 in a year. Australia has an exceptional abundance of deadly snakes, most of whose species are evolutionary relatives of the cobras. Unless you are an expert, it is wise to stay clear of every snake in Australia, just as it is wise to avoid wild mushrooms anywhere in the world. In South and Central America live deadly snakes well known to the Jivaro and Vega Talista shamans, including the Bushmaster, Fer de Lance, and Heracara, which are among the largest and most aggressive of the pit vipers. Possessing skins patterned and colored like fallen leaves, and fangs long enough to pass through a human hand, they wait in ambush on the floor of the tropical forest for small birds and mammals, and are quick to deliver defensive strikes at passing humans. Snakes and dream serpents provide an example of how agents of nature can be translated into the symbols of culture. For hundreds of thousands of years, time enough for genetic changes in the brain to program the algorithms of prepared learning, poisonous snakes have been a significant source of injury and death to human beings. The response to the threat is not simply to avoid it in the way that certain berries are recognized as poisonous through painful trial and error, but to feel the kind of apprehension and morbid fascination displayed in the presence of snakes by the non-human primates. The snake image also attracts many extraneous details that are purely learned, and as a result, the intense emotion it evokes enriches cultures around the world. The tendency of the serpent to appear suddenly in trances and dreams, its sinuous form, and its power and mystery are logical ingredients of myth and religion. Amerindian images stretch back through the millennia. Prior to the Pharaonic dynasties, the kings of Lower Egypt were crowned at Buto by the cobra goddess Wajet. In Greece, there was Ouroboros, the serpent that continuously devoured itself tail first while regenerating from the inside. For Gnostics and alchemists of later centuries, this self-cannibal came to symbolize the eternal cycle of destruction and recreation of the world. One day, in 1865, while dozing by a fire, the German chemist Friedrich August Kikole von Stradonitz dreamed of Ouroboros and thereby conceived of the benzene molecule as a circle of 6 carbon atoms, each bonded to a hydrogen atom. Because of that inspiration, some of the most puzzling data of 19th century organic chemistry fell into place. In the Aztec pantheon, Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent with a human head, ruled as the god of the morning and evening star, and thus of death and resurrection. He was the inventor of the calendar and patron of learning and the priesthood. Tlaloc, god of rain and lightning, was another serpentine chimera, with humanoid upper lips formed from 2 rattlesnake heads. Such apparitions could have been born only in dreams and trances. In mind and culture, the serpent transcends the snake. An understanding of its transformation from an earthly reptile can be viewed as one of many pathways through the borderlands that separate science from the humanities. Having followed the serpent a considerable distance in our journey from magician to atom, we next enter the interior of the biological sciences. Here, better maps are available, and progress considerably easier. Scores of Nobel Prizes, the fruit of millions of hours of labor and billions of dollars allocated to biomedical research, point the way on down through the sciences from body and organ through cell to molecule and atom. The general structure of the human nerve cell has now been charted in considerable detail. Its electric discharge and synaptic chemistry are partly understood and can be expressed in formulas obedient to the principles of physics and chemistry. The stage has been set to attack the master unsolved problem of biology: how the 100 billion nerve cells of the brain work together to create consciousness. I say the master problem because the most complex systems known to exist in the universe are biological, and by far the most complex of all biological phenomena is the human mind. If brain and mind are at base biological phenomena, it follows that the biological sciences are essential to achieving coherence among all the branches of learning, from the humanities on down to the physical sciences. The task is made somewhat easier by the fact that disciplines within biology itself are now generally consilient and growing more so each year. I would like to explain how this has been accomplished. Consilience among the biological sciences is based on a thorough understanding of scale in time and space. Passing from one level to the next, say molecule to cell or organ to organism, requires the correct orchestration of changes in time and space. To make the point, I will return for a last time to Pablo Amaringo, magician, artist, and fellow organism. Imagine that we can speed or slow the time we spend with him while expanding or shrinking the space we see in and around his person. So we enter his house, we shake his hand, and Amaringo shows us a painting. The actions consume seconds or minutes, an obvious fact, so why mention it? The question makes more sense when put in another form. Why did these familiar actions not consume millionths of seconds or months instead? The answer is that human beings are constructed of billions of cells that communicate across membranes by chemical surges and electrical impulses. To see and speak with Amaringo entails a sequence of these units covering seconds to minutes, not microseconds or months. We think of that span of time as normal and somehow standard for the world in which we live. It is not. Because it involves Amaringo and us, all of whom are organic machines, it is only organismic time. And because the full apparatus of our communication takes up from